Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For thousands of years, dogs were the world's only domesticated animal. 5, 10, maybe even 30,000 years ago, they connected with humans, and the connection has stuck. So how did all that happen? And how did the Ice Age dog become the golden retriever, not to mention all the other breeds that may be laying on your living room floor? There are conflicting answers, but a worldwide study is on, tracing the ancient DNA of wolf and dog fossils and giving us new clues. This hour on Point, where dogs come from. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. How do you picture the beginning of the dog? Do you see wolf in your cocker spaniel, your pug? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. All kinds of breeds now, after all kinds of evolution and breeding and all the rest. Here's some commentators at the Westminster Kennel Club Dog Show, Madison Square Garden, a couple of years back, talking about a border collie's unique features and talents.
This is border collie number 17.
Borders have a lot of fans, too.
Oh, yeah. Time. It's the coloring and the beautiful expression on their faces, huh?
That intense look in their eyes. They actually use their eyes to control their flock. World's premier sheep herding dog. No question about it.
The border collie, and no doubt a very fine one. How did we get there? From whatever and from when? Joining me now from Oxford, England, is Gregor Larson. He's a professor of evolutionary genomics at Oxford University, where he runs the Paleogenomics and Bioarchaeology Research Network. He is director of the Ancient Dog Project. Gregor Larson, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What are you exploring, sir?
Just that, really. It's the origins of our most famous and most loved pet.
You have said, called the dog the first domesticated anything, plant or animal. Paint that picture for us.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Dogs are unusual in that regard, in that most animals were domesticated after the advent of settled agriculture. But dogs were domesticated at least several thousand years prior to that by mobile groups of hunter-gatherers somewhere in Eurasia.
Now, that means before anything else, and you're still going with the wolf-to-dog theory, is that because your Ancient Dog Project has proven that already, or is it just somehow obvious to you?
Well, luckily for us, other people have done that heavy lifting, and that is the one thing that all dog researchers are united on. In fact, it's so open and closed that it's not a contentious issue. In fact, it's probably the only non-contentious issue within dog evolution and dog origins, is that without question, dogs were descended from not just gray wolves in general, because of course we have gray wolves in North America as well, but must have been the old world gray wolf, which somewhere between, say, Portugal and Siberia.
I hesitate to question you, but I've heard what feel like meta questions coming up lately. We'll look at that. As far as the scientific record now, then, how do you understand the process by which that wild wolf, the gray wolf, becomes a domestic dog? How's it work?
That's a great question, and quite a few people have had a lot of answers for this. And I think later on in this program, we'll be speaking with somebody who's done a lot of research on this as well. Our own working hypothesis, and of course it's difficult to demonstrate this because it's a process, it takes place over a long period of time, it's probably got a lot of different stages to it, and those are difficult to pick up in the archaeological record. So we have to use proxies of one kind or another. Mm-hmm. But one interesting idea that's come out over in the last couple of years that was really initiated by a researcher named Bob Wayne at UCLA, he was telling me with his wife, Blair Van Valkenburg, and they were saying that there are these things called ecomorphs, which it's a kind of a fancy way of saying almost cultures within a species. So okay. If you think about Arctic foxes, for instance, there are Arctic foxes on Iceland who hunt exclusively the stuff that they can find on the beach. Mm-hmm. And they just forest birds and eggs and these sorts of things. And then there are the lemming foxes, the same species. They look to you and me exactly the same, but instead of doing that as their major primary source, they instead go for lemmings. And they chase lemmings all over the the ice flows, and they will go up to 4,000 kilometers a year. And so the lemming foxes and the foxes on the beach will sort of recognize each other. They know each other, but they don't really interact that much. And occasionally they'll interbreed and have some offspring, but they're a little bit confused. And and it's the same thing in killer whales off the northwest coast of the U.S. There are some killer whale pods that hunt exclusively salmon and others that hunt exclusively seals. And again, they know each other, they get along, they recognize each other's calls are being slightly different, but they don't really, there's not a lot of interaction
between
them.
They don't behave in the same way. So take that to dogs and or wolves and the origin of dogs maybe. How, what?
Exactly. So in this regard, what we tend to think of these as, you know, it's almost like the sharks and the jets where there's a lot of recognition, or maybe for NPR listeners, we're thinking about the Capulets and the Montagues, you know, where it's, there are attempts to interbreed, but they're probably doomed from the start. So when it comes to wolves, what we're thinking is that there is a population of wolves somewhere in Asia or Western Eurasia, Eastern Eurasia, and instead of following something else that they're hunting, they start following the mobile hunter-gatherers. They start following people, and they start making use of the resources that those people are providing.
You mean one of these strands of the gray wolf family sort of latches on to, is it Homo sapien at that point? Or is it still...
Oh, yeah, definitely, definitely. I mean, even people who are arguing for an early domestication of dogs at 30,000 years ago, I mean, this is your uncle. This is just anybody on the street. It wouldn't be any different from us. And in North America, there's wolves that follow caribou exclusively and wolves that just stay in the forest exclusively. So we know that there is this differentiation between wolf populations pursuing different resource strategies. So one possibility is that rather than doing something else, they latch onto us, as you describe, and they, through that process, there is a selection pressure in place, and those that are best able to take advantage of that niche that we've created are the ones that are a bit more tame, a bit more curious, have shorter fight or flight distances, and those are the ones that are reproducing, and therefore that selection pressure leads to a kind of a baseline level of curiosity and ability then to be tamed a little bit more, and only then do humans maybe start getting involved with some more direct selection for things that are more of interest to us. But the whole process has to start off with an unintentionality, because there's no way 30,000 years ago, your uncle or my uncle, with no experience or having observed any domesticated anything ever, I mean, your complete worldview is everything is wild, that you would imagine that you could pick up a puppy from a den of a wolf, which is probably not something that's terribly friendly to you in the first place, and bring it back and then expect it to turn into some fun plaything for your three-year-old
without
eating it.
In other words, you see maybe the wolf or the early dog taking the lead here, not the human, not the uncle ancient reaching into the den, or human saying, hey, come here, little friendly looking wolf at the edge of my fire, maybe I'll give you a caribou antler.
Yeah, I agreed. It's difficult for me to see how anybody would have had the forethought to imagine a multi-generational process whereby you have to impart a very strong selection pressure on a carnivore that you simply, I mean, nobody brings wild animals directly as wild animals into their houses. You'd be a fool to go out and grab a bear cub and try and bring it in your house and expect that suddenly you've got domesticated bears.
People try it. People do it.
Well, and my understanding is they don't do it terribly successfully. I mean, there's whole movies about this, right?
Yes, like lunch, breakfast, the
precisely,
human.
Precisely.
But I see how that gets wolves and humans joined up. So you get an ecomorphs, a pack or a strain of wolves that follow humans. They become a primary source of food, I guess.
And that's a great question about you need another step there. And so one possibility is that, you know, wolves that are following caribous are very resistant to other packs of wolves taking advantage of that same resource. So they, in a way, that we become the kind of way in which those wolves are getting their sustenance. And so they're going to protect that. So they might start acting accidentally, really, as sentinels. So if there's other things in the area, they'll start howling or start finding something off. And then look at that. Look what the wolves did there. Or another possibility is that wolves have skills that we simply don't. And so if we've seen wolves hunting or they've seen us hunting, and we know that, for instance, if you use a very small blade and you can cut an animal and it's in a reasonably forested area, that animal will run and then hide, figuring that we can't find it. And of course we can't, because the camouflage is excellent and our noses aren't very good. A wolf, however, or a dog for that matter, can find those things. And so suddenly a wolf, a dog in that hunting scenario becomes a very valuable tool that we would not have had otherwise. And so there's a real mutual benefit that's taking place. And we know that there are several hunter-gatherer cultures between 5 and 10,000 years ago that are burying their dogs in the same way that they, you and I would bury a king, where they have unbelievable grave goods. They're being treated and respected as like the highest members of society, and these are dogs. And there clearly is a hunting association there whereby they have become so ingratiated into human culture that really they're kind of one and the same. It's just one pack of humans and people, and they're hunting very effectively.
And you're assuming that, what, humans must have been pretty good hunters before they got hooked up with dogs because humans had food to drop or share somehow.
Sure. And, you know, clearly they were successful because you and I are here now. And so everybody's been able to mate and reproduce and have fertile offspring. So, which isn't to say that we were bad at it, but of course, any advantage you have to make you better at it is great. And it, just because you're good at it doesn't mean you're necessarily efficient at it either. I mean, humans are very good at running animals off cliffs I think there's some sites that are over 100,000 years old in Jersey, not the U.S. Jersey, the English Jersey, where there's evidence of mass kills. Well, you know, if you're mass killing an animal by running it off a cliff, which is, there's a lot of ethnographic evidence for that globally, suddenly it's not like we are just taking absolutely every single piece and leaving nothing for anybody else that happens to be hanging around. If there's a wolf pack hanging around, well, they're going to take advantage of that resource as well.
And as you say, burials that show a lot of respect for those, I don't know, at that point, back in the Mesolithic period, are you calling them dogs or are you calling them
Absolutely.
Wolves?
Absolutely. No, there are definitely dogs in the Mesolithic, without question. And that's the point of domestic animals, well, domestic dogs for that matter, being associated with mobile hunter-gatherers who have nothing whatsoever to do with agriculture. Nobody's settled, nobody's planting, they're taking advantage of plant resources for sure, but nobody's engaged in the kind of agricultural practices that we associate with the Near East 10,000 years ago.
Amazing. Are we talking, do we know geographically where this connection may have first occurred? What part of the planet?
Well, no, is the short answer. There's been some speculation that this is happening in Europe. Quite a bit of evidence that's come out in support of an East Asian origin, and recently more Central Asia. So right now it could be anywhere on the map.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about where dogs came from, the evolution of man's best friend. Behind us right there, a pack of gray wolves in Quebec, Canada. You can join us. Where do you think dogs came from? What if it was wolves choosing humans to live off, to live with? And what's your question, your thought on how dogs evolved? What about breeds? You go from wolves to, here's the distinctive yip of the Chihuahua. A long way from wolf country, or at least adult wolf. And here, back to the Westminster Dog Show, we get into all the breeds. We'll look at that as well. 2015, describing a pointer, Michael Lefebvre.
A pointer is one of the oldest sporting breeds. As his name implies, the pointer points with his nose. As he searches for game, using his highly developed sense of smell, and having found it, he freezes into that classical point. A pointer named Sensation is the emblem of the Westminster Kennel Club. A hunting dog, he is most importantly an excellent family companion.
Excellent family companion. The wolves would not have been that, but it's a long, long time since that connection was made. Gregor Larson is with us. He's director of the Ancient Dog Project at Oxford. They're pulling genetic information from all over the world, fossils, to look at the very, very early record of what went on with wolves and dogs. You hear his view of what happened. Definitely wolf in origin. We'll look more at that. Let me get a call for you, Gregor. Anthony in Dover, Delaware. You're on with Mr. Larson, Professor Larson, in Oxford, England.
Hi, how you doing, Tom?
Very well.
Glad that you guys took my call. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I always think that humans are a little bit too impressed with their own skills and their own abilities. I've seen a lot of videos of chimpanzees hunting other animals. I could easily see a predator following a troop of chimpanzees, and I wouldn't consider them to be as an effective hunter as some of our Neanderthal men. I also remember seeing videos of baboons living together with wild dogs in some of the junkyards down in Africa. And I think that it might be a case of where these animals enjoy each other company further back in the record than what we're talking about.
Or even before we get to enjoyment, just found a practical reason to tolerate one another and a kind of partnership there But that notion of dogs or wolves choosing humans rather than the other way around makes sense to you. I appreciate your call, Anthony. Gregor Larson, please stand by in Oxford. I want to welcome into our conversation from Brussels in Belgium, Mitja Heerman-Pre. She's a paleontologist from the Royal Belgian Institute of the Natural Sciences, studies prehistoric canines and the early domestication of the wolf, I guess. Mitja, thank you very much for being with us today.
Yes, thank you, Tom, for inviting me.
What have you found looking back at very, very old skulls when it comes to wolves and maybe dogs?
Yes, we have here in our institute very nice collections of mammals from the Ice Age, and I was studying those. And we also have two very well-preserved complete skulls of canids, and we wanted to look into this material in more detail to have a look if one of these could be an early dog. And because one skull is really smaller, quite smaller, and falls outside the range of wolves in terms of size. And we looked into detail in this skull and compared it with recent wolves and with recent dogs, but northern dogs, mm-hmm. like huskies. Mm-hmm. And we found out that this skull was really different from the wolves and resembled more these northern dogs and also more this also more prehistoric dogs. And that's why we proposed that this was the skull of an early dog.
So, and you're going very far back here, maybe 28, 30, 36,000 years. Are you suggesting with that, Professor Heerman-Pre, that that this was not evolved from the wolf, but rather a distinct line of its own?
No. We okay. think they evolved from wolves from the Ice Age. They were really, mm-hmm. they are belonging to the group of the large canids, and they evolved from, in our opinion, they were domesticated from wolves from the Ice Age.
You have found dogs' skulls with perforated skulls, I guess, holes in the skull.
It yes.
suggests humans opened those skulls and took the brains out. Why would that have happened?
Well, this could have been a ritual treatment of these skulls. They could have eaten this the brains, the prehistoric people. But we think it could be an indication of a ritual. We also found such a primitive dog skull with a bone between its teeth, and like it was being fed just before it died or after it died, so perimortem. And we think this was an indication also of a ritual. And these particular skulls were found in a Czechia, in a site which is about 30,000 years ago. And this is a prehistoric site, so the site its name is Primosti.
Mm-hmm.
And it's human skeletons were also found in this site, and also perforated teeth of wolves or dogs that were used as jewelry. So there was really a very close interaction between humans and canids at this site, and also in some other sites from European Ice Age.
Intimacy with canines way back then. Mitja Heerman-Pre, looking at skulls in Belgium and in the Czech Republic and in Russia. Mitja, Gregor Larson, please stand by. Questions for you. Ray in Wausau, Wisconsin. Ray, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hello. I was just wondering if there's any evidence for root dogs, like the rough, rustic form of an original dog that maybe resembled a mastiff or a pointer or an Anatolian shepherd or something that would carry the genes of a whole bunch of different breeds that we have now.
Mm-hmm. I'll take it to both of my guests, Ray. Gregor Larson, what about a kind of root dog or breed? When you are looking at these skulls and fossils, do they suggest an appearance? Should we assume they just look wolf-like, or were they differentiating quickly?
It's a very good question, and wanted to say hi to Mitya, who is we've been collaborating for a couple of years now at least, and it's lovely to be on the radio together. That's a great question. We know, and Mitya can correct me here, but I think that there are some early sites, 8,000-9,000 years ago, where there appears to be some fossils of dogs that are different sizes, which seems to suggest that relatively early on in the process, people were selecting for dogs to do different things. And, you know, I think calling them a breed might be a bit too far, but certainly there may have been different types of dogs. And the evidence for that is it's there, and it's, I think it's a little bit contentious, but certainly I think pretty quickly, and we know from other animals as well, that things like coat color changes were happening very fast. And so as soon as an animal goes from a wild context into something where humans are the ones making the decisions about who lives and who dies and what we're selecting for, I think you start to get a lot of those telltale traits proliferating through those domestic populations. So I don't think it's completely crazy to think that some of the early dogs possessed some traits that we today would recognize as being very much associated with domestic animals.
Let me get one more call on that front, and I'll bring it to you, Mitya. Mike in Charlotte, North Carolina. Mike, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Greg may be familiar with the documentary I saw. A man had done a test with foxes, and within about three or four generations of domesticating the foxes, taking the friendliest ones and breeding the friendliest one to the, you know, the ones that don't have the flight or fight risk or you know, gene in them, within about three or four generations, he was able to, the dogs actually changed colors, stopped, they didn't produce their own natural camouflage anymore. They started being born black and white and then developed barking. And in that same documentary, I saw that they said the same thing could have easily happened within just three or four generations with wolves once they started depending on people for their sustenance, that it would have been much easier to then, you know, have them as part of their daily life situation.
Mike, I appreciate your call. Mitya Hermanpre, it's hard to imagine changes in color and everything happening so fast. You found fossils where, with a very wide and short snout, much smaller, quite different from wolf. How long do you imagine that that kind of differentiation might have taken?
Well, it probably took much longer during the Ice Age, because this experiment was carried out in Novosibirsk, and it's still going on. It was started in the 1950s by a professor, Belyaev, and he wanted to test the hypothesis that people had domesticated wolves by selecting on the behavior of the animals. But he didn't want to test this with wolves because it was, well, too difficult, and he started this experiment with a close related canid, which are the foxes. And yes, very soon, very quickly, he there were changes in the behavior, changes in the morphology and the colors of the animals and the shape of and the size of the skulls. And this was a very severe selection. So especially in the beginning, only a few percent of each generation was permitted to breed. So I think this did not happen in Paleolithic times. This took much more time, of course, because people did not have a forethought. They did not. No. I don't think they had. Someone woke up in the morning and said, "Today I will domesticate a wolf."
And someday there will be Petco and Westminster just, Dog Show and all the rest.
Precisely.
Right. Mitya Hermanpre, we appreciate your taking a little time out from this research. It's really terrific, and we're grateful to you for joining us from the Royal Belgian Institute of the Natural Sciences. We wish you good luck, and we will follow your results as they come. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let me get another call right here. Terry in Watertown, New York. Terry, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoy your show very much. Listen
Thank
to
you.
It every day.
Great. Thank you.
Well, so my perspective on this subject is one of interest, in as much as when I was a child, very young, we picked up a stray puppy that was in a snowbank, and we had him for a month, and then went to the veterinarian to get his shots done, and the veterinarian informed us that what we had was a timber wolf. Now, we asked, how will we know for sure? And, of course, he said, you'll know based on his size and behavior patterns. The animal male did become very large, and he was our domestic pet. Now, whether he was actually a timber wolf, we never really knew, nor did we care. He was unique in his behavior in as much as he did not depend on us for his food. He actually hunted his food. Although his appetite was voracious and he would gladly eat anything you presented to him, he would, on a daily basis, hunt for food. And yet he was, nonetheless, a domestic pet of the most amazing intelligent little
animal. Did he eat the neighbor's dogs, Terry?
No.
How about
the
cats?
He tended to be territorial. He was a babysitter to all of us. He would always be there ghosting us, watching out for us. But he was just an amazing animal. His intelligence was remarkable.
Terry, let me hold the story right there. It sounds amazing, clearly relevant to us thinking about humans interacting with wolves early on. Gregor, are you prepared to buy that Boots, Terry's Boots, was a timber wolf, full-on timber wolf?
I've talked to a lot of people. Nobody seems to know what a timber wolf is, other than a basketball player from Minnesota. There's a lot of different definitions for that. It's a great story, and it's certainly intriguing. My understanding of having been to a number of, well, certainly in Austria, to the Wolf Center, where you're allowed in a cage or in a pen with wolves, but those wolves have been hand-reared from birth by people. So they've imprinted on people, they've been socialized with human beings, and even then, they're still very much wild animals. And you're given very strict instructions of when you go in not to make any sudden moves or do anything untoward, because these wolves will react in a way that you probably wouldn't find very sociable. So, mm-hmm. It's entirely possible that this was a hybrid between a wolf and a dog, which we know happens, It's difficult to say, and certainly there's variability in wolf behavior as well. So, I wouldn't rule it out completely, and it sounds like a great story.
Terry, I appreciate your call. Gregor, stand by in Oxford. Ray Coppinger joins us right now from Springfield, Massachusetts, professor emeritus of biology at Hampshire College. Latest book is How Dogs Work with Mark Feinstein, also co-author with Lorna Coppinger of Dogs, A Startling New Understanding of Canine Origin, Behavior, and Evolution. Ray Coppinger, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being here.
Hey, thank you for having me.
How does your startling new understanding line up with the first results coming out of Gregor Larson's Ancient Dog Project, Ray?
I love it being here right now and being able to listen to Greg. I've never met him before, but I've read his material. And certainly that's true of Professor Jumon Pre. I would go back and say that the problem with this is that we're starting off with a certain kinds of assumptions that the dog, something turned into the dog between 15 and 30,000 years ago.
You mean a wolf turned into a dog is the presumption?
No, here. I don't mean a wolf turned into a dog. Something in the genus Canis turned into a dog.
Oh.
I've written articles and books myself of what is a wolf. I mean, that it's not like there was one type form of a wolf, and all of us who have worked with dogs worldwide think that the original animal was about 30 pounds. They weren't big animals, and they're not big animals now. If you go and you look at breeds of dogs and you look at big breeds of dogs, they deform. Their skulls deform in a way that suggests that they are changing from a smaller animal to a bigger animal. Now, I think it's interesting that people will argue about this early view of animals, but there are papers in the literature, in the science, peer-reviewed papers that say you can't measure those skulls like Professor Jumon Pre did two-dimensionally. You have to go to three-dimensional. And when you go to a three-dimensional measurement of the skulls, they're not dogs. They're wolves.
This On Point podcast is made possible by Squarespace. If you have a passion that you obsess over, if it keeps you up at night, if you live for it, you should show it off. With easy-to-use tools and templates, Squarespace websites help you capture every detail of what drives you. Because if it's worth the effort, it's worth showing to the world. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com. When you're ready to purchase, use the one-word offer code ONPOINT to save 10%. You should. Squarespace.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about where dogs come from, the evolution of man's best friend, with Gregor Larson, joins us from Oxford, professor of evolutionary genomics there and director of the Ancient Dog Project, and with Ray Coppinger, professor emeritus of biology at Hampshire College, author, co-author of How Dogs Work and Dogs, with his own big take on dog evolution. You can join us this hour. Where do you think dogs came from? And what about breeds? Breeders, are you fighting evolution or are you evolution? All kinds of dogs out there, how wonderful it is. Here's the bark of a big German Shepherd. The guard dog sound there. Here's the quintessential Golden Retriever bark. Here's my latest favorite, I hope she's listening, the beagle. Oh. Hey, my beagle sounds better than that. Come on. And wolves? Sure. Everybody wants us to think about wolves when we think about dogs. Blue Buffalo dog food ads goes right at it. Here's a bit that features one adorable images of puppies and baby wolves.
From the moment a puppy comes into the world, the soul of a wolf is also born. And even as adults, they continue to share an evolutionary connection, one that's best reflected in their love for meat.
Meat, the soul of a wolf, I don't know, but we've got Gregor Larson and Ray Coppinger right here. Michelle in Dedham, Massachusetts, calling for Ray. Michelle, thanks, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me. Mm-hmm. I'm a professional dog trainer here, and I saw Ray speak a couple of years ago and read his book, and it really, all of this information changes the way that we actually train our dogs. There's still some personalities out there on TV that tote the information that if you are just the pack leader in your house, everything else is going to fall into place.
Oh, yeah.
Dogs aren't wolves, and they behave differently. And so, you know, it kind of makes us have to take responsibility for actually applying the principles of operant conditioning and classical conditioning and changing behavior versus just falling behind some facade that dogs are just small wolves.
Michelle, I so appreciate your call. Ray Coppinger, you hear the ad there saying when a dog is born, the soul of a wolf is born. You and Michelle has certainly picked up on this as sort of breaking some of that connection. So there's a wolf in there or not, Ray? And if not, then what?
The dog is a member of the genus Canis, and it's very, very different from all the other members of the genus. Now, I've collected hybrids all over the world, not only between wolves and dogs, but between coyotes and dogs, between jackals and dogs, and so on. And those animals are very, very different than dogs. They're different in training. I've raised wolves. And my graduate students raise wolves, and we study the puppies, and it takes something like 2,000 hours to raise a puppy so that it's tame, so that you can go into the cage with it.
You mean when they're hybrid with a wild canine?
I switched right there to pure wolves. Mm, we raise wolves, mm-hmm. And we have a laboratory where we do it, mm-hmm. And and it takes 2,000 hours. Now, I'd like to throw it out to somebody like Greg. Do you think Mesolithic people running around trying to earn a living had 2,000 hours to raise a puppy?
Gregor, does that throw doubt on the wolf origin?
Well, the first thing I should say is that commercial made me think that I should probably have my own theme music. I think that makes things a lot more credible.
And a fog machine whenever you step on stage.
Not even on stage, just walking down the street.
Okay.
I just want fog and wind, and that'd be much better. People would pay more attention to me.
Yeah.
I think the genetic evidence is absolutely clear. I mean, Ray is absolutely right that there are numerous examples of dogs hybridizing and producing fertile offspring with a wide range of other canids, but the dogs themselves have without question come from the gray wolf. So, but Ray is also right in that there are a huge variety of gray wolves. Some are solo hunters, some hunt in packs. There is, especially when you go back to the late Pleistocene, we see that there are wolves hunting a wide range of megafauna in both North America and in Europe. And in many cases, those lineages have gone extinct. So, you know, I think it's absolutely right. We tend to think of wolf as just a single item, a single thing that we reify into the kind of dog or the proto-dog. But there is enormous flexibility in behavior and size. And I mean, just given the fact that they exist all over North and South America or North America and all over Eurasia, they're a huge expanse as a wild animal that, you know, they're having to compete in a wide range of environments, which means they're very plastic. And so I would say that we risk pigeonholing them at our own expense. And I think that the more that we take into account the variability in wolves, the more that we can understand the process of domestication itself.
Does that variability, Ray Coppinger, warm you to the notion, yes, it was a wolf of some kind?
No. I just shy away from that, is that all this, these arguments that the dog came from the wolf, that they came from the wolf in the Mesolithic or pre 15,000 years from now, to me is just speculation. And Greg wrote a paper and said, a couple of years ago, let's reanalyze the genetic data on determining where the dog came from, what the genetics was telling us. And basically what he said in that paper was that no two of these experiments, these genetic experiments, came up with the same set of results. It doesn't seem to be repeatable science. And so you've got different laboratories out there arguing about whether it was Southeast Asia or whether it was the Middle East or whether it was up in Europe and so forth. I don't think the methodology is going to tell you that. And I think that evolutionary biologists have known this for a long time, because there's certain things that you can't account for.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have a genomics dogfight right here. I don't know if we can settle it, but we've certainly got a lot of questions, and I want to get to the issue of breeds. Greg in Columbia, South Carolina. Greg, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
I just want to let you know it's my firm belief that human civilization is the dog's greatest achievement.
The dogs invented it. Dogs made it happen. What do you mean, Greg?
Well, I mean, the fossil record, they show we're together, and as they've said, they were somewhere buried as kings. So, you know, when it's a fossil record, you're left with some speculation, and we don't know that the dogs didn't select us to be the kings of the planet as we feel we are now.
Maybe you're right. Maybe you're right. Ray Coppinger, how about the notion that it wasn't humans picking dogs, wolves out of dens, but some kind of canine that selected us and made that choice?
I've got a new book coming out in April, and it goes into that question in detail, is that as I study dogs around the world, there's a billion dogs out there in the world, and there's only about 200 million of them that are under human reproductive control. So you have 800 million dogs out there who have evolved to a niche, which is to scavenge off human settlements. Now, dogs aren't the only one that have done that. The pigeons have done that.
Mm-hmm.
The cockroaches have done that. Or rats have done that, and so on. Now, these are animals. These are not domesticated animals. These are domestic animals, which just means they live in the presence of people. All right? Their niche is within the realm of people, agriculture, whatever. And so, when do you get that agricultural revolution? Well, you get it somewhere around 10,000 years ago. When do you start getting dogs drawn on cave walls where people are burying them with kings or whatever else? And it's 7,000 to 8,000 years ago. And before that, it's all this wonderful genetic and morphological methodology, and I don't think it works.
I want to get to the issue of breeds as well. It's such a big one. But one more right here. Mark in West Bloomfield, Michigan. Mark, you're on the air.
Hello. I read a study that said the Newfoundland was the only genetically domesticated animal of North America. Supposedly the Algonquin Indians domesticated this animal as a pack animal and used them up to the time the Spaniards came in with horses, and then the horses took over. But I find it interesting, the origin of dogs.
Mark, let us pick it up. Gregory Larson, let's go to breeds. I mean, Lisa asked us online. She says, I can't imagine how a Maltese could be a wolf descendant. Whatever that canine is, how do we get to breeds? I know breeds went, humans went crazy, you know, breeding breeds in the 19th century, but Algonquins are way before that. How does this huge diversity of shape and size and behavior emerge in dogs, Gregor?
It's down to a very strong human selective pressure. I mean, evolution is a very plastic thing, and it will respond to selective pressure. I mean, like we were discussing before with the foxes in Siberia, if you put a selection on something where you only allow 10% of the most extreme example of a morphology or of a behavior to allow to reproduce to the next generation, you're going to see really rapid change, and you'll start exploring the boundaries of biological limits, whether that's size or color or behavior or movement or any number of things. So it's a testament to the plasticity of biology and the power of evolution.
What does the fossil record say about when breeds or very, very distinct lines of dogs begin to appear?
It's a tough question. I think that people, we were mentioning earlier about how, you know, there's some evidence that 7,000 or 8,000 years ago at the same site, you get dogs of different sizes all buried on the same site, which would suggest that there is, people are not just actively selecting for one type, but trying to get populations of different types of dogs. Like if you went to Central Park now and you see big ones and little ones and whatever else. But we know for certain that the Romans were very good at having very small dogs around, either as bed warmers or just as, you know, up somebody's sleeve, is just a way to kind of show off their wealth, and just as pets running around without any other purpose, is just for other, just companionship. So we know that sort of process of having sort of teacup breeds or teacup dogs and things have been going back for at least 2,000 years, and it's possible that it's gone back even further than that, but it's difficult to say.
Ray, you hear Mark, our callers, asking about Newfoundlands, Newfies, and the Algonquin. Give us your narrative on the emergence of these very distinct and very diverse breeds.
There's really three processes that go along on making a breed. One is that you get an explorer that goes out there and he finds a land race, which is a population of dogs that is just a little different than other dogs in the world. And you bring that home, and in order to have a breed, you've got to sexually isolate that animal and breed from it. And so if you look at, for example, dogs like the Great Pyrenees, you know, in the 1930s, a lady went to the Great Pyrenees Mountains, and she sorted through the variety of dogs, and she brought home the white ones.
Yep.
And then they are then sexually isolated from other Great Pyrenees. In the 70s, I was hired by the Anatolian Shepherd Dog Club to go to Europe, go to Turkey, and sort through thousands of dogs out there to find the real Anatolian Shepherd, which I did. And I brought back some 30 animals that became part of the breeding stock of that. And by 1996, they had a registered breed at the American Kennel Club.
In 25 years, boom.
Yeah, and so that's one breed that starts off as a land race dog in Turkey and ends up as a registered breed. The second way you get a breed is by mutations. So most of the differences that you see in dogs are really simple mutations. If you take something like the Dachshund or the Basset Hound, what you get there is a genetic system that they call a chondroplasia. And every animal I know in the world, including humans, have this mutation from time to time and so on.
But humans are so much less diverse when we look at our human population than dogs across breeds.
Come on. If you went out, and I went to a conference one time of dwarfs.
Hey, I can find you a dog 40 times bigger than another dog. You can't find me a human 40 times bigger than another.
I agree with you.
Shaquille O'Neal is pretty big.
But he's big, but still.
the fact is that what you're doing is you're picking up mutations for either color or for some kind of morphology or face length or size or whatever. And then you sexually isolate that mutation and you breed from it. And then the most common way of getting new breeds is to crossbreed old breeds. And so right now in this country, there's the Labradoodle or whatever. People make up a dog. They'll cross two morphological forms. And what you get is you get something that's totally new. And so that's the three basic way breeds get made. And most of it happened in the 19th century.
Gregor, is breeding a face of evolution or is it somehow apart from evolution?
Oh, it's all part of the same thing. I mean, it's funny. All this talk of sexual isolation is giving me flashbacks to high school. It's the same thing with dogs, though. And Ray is absolutely right. I mean, the key thing is what the Victorian setup that hadn't really been in place before was reifying a type of dog to say this is the breed standard for this particular dog. We're going to have a full pedigree, and we're not going to allow any dogs outside of this grouping to mate with dogs on the other side. And by setting up those boundaries and really restricting gene flow between one breed and another, it not only reduced genetic variability in that, but it really made that everything became a very uniform type within a particular breed. And that was a real revolution in the 19th century.
I mean, Ray reminds us that maybe 50 generations in dog world is only 150 or 200 years. 50 generations is a lot of breeding. What a story. What a grand, long story. It's interesting to hear the dogfight angle on it between you all who know so much. But we learn just listening to your exchange, and we're so grateful for it. Gregor Lawson is director of the Ancient Dog Project at Oxford, Longing for a Fog Machine and theme music. We hope you get it, Gregor, and thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Ray Coppinger, author of How Dogs Work and Dogs and More Coming. Ray, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you.
Terrific to have you. I should say our Twitter feed at On Point Radio is full of pictures of your dogs right now. Tweet us yours. In this hour on Monday, we talk with comedian and actor Sacha Baron Cohen. Ali G and Borat and Bruno, he's back. He's with us. Don't miss it. Thanks for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. ¶¶